Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is International Financial Management, FIL 344, for spring semester 2022. Today, exchange rate arbitrage. Now, I have a kind of an odd story, and I certainly would not have called it that at the time when I was a child many, many years ago. Yes, in the Neolithic period. Some of my relatives went to Canada quite frequently for fishing and hunting, and they would tell the story, and I didn't quite get it, that, see, there was a treaty between the United States and Canada, and technically that treaty is still there, although it's violated all the time by the United States now, but that the Canadian dollar and the American dollar were the same. It was a pegged one-to-one between Canada and the United States because there was such a special relationship we had with them, the longest unfortressed border in the world, I think it was, and all of that. And now they'll have a fit at you if you hand a Canadian nickel to a U.S. merchant. But back in the day, it was perfectly fixed. But after Bretton Woods began to come apart, there was a trading difference between the two. And I was racking my brain down. Unfortunately, all of my relatives are dead, so I can't ask them about it. But if I recall right, an American dollar was worth a dollar, 1.04 Canadian dollars. But the treaty said they had to be exchanged one for one, even though with the collapse of Bretton Woods, there was an actual difference starting to show up. And this was in the late 60s. And so, apparently, there were these people who lived near the border between Canada and the United States who would simply gather up. How did it work? Gather up dollars. Every day they would do this. They would just gather up like $500, go across the border to an exchange station, and get $1.04 dollars Canadian for it. Then they would bring them back here, and they would get $104 American dollars back because the banks down on the American side were honoring the one-to-one. And so that was what we call locational arbitrage. And this went on for more than a few years, as I recall, because I think after my father passed in 69, one of his old friends was still doing it from northern Ohio every now and then. But you got to understand, that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're doing it every day, and back then, you do $500, that's $20, and it was a decent amount of money back then just doing that. And yeah. You only do it once a day. That was the thing, was there were husband-wife teams that were doing it. Each of them, they'd go in one car, but they split up and head to different exchange stations to do it, or banks in Canada to do it. And then they come back down here, and they'd go to different banks down here across town from each other. And it was like a machine, but yeah, I mean, they would, and then there was a story of how the kids got involved in it, and the one girl was a teenager, and she got into it. They were making their living doing this, just essentially locational arbitrage every day. And finally, it ended because there was no longer any place you could get the locational arbitrage. Now, a basic term here, and I've used this, and you probably already know what it is. Arbitrage is taking advantage of small differences in the price of the same thing in different markets. Arbitrage is taking advantage of price differences in different places or at different times, it could be. Now, arbitrage is actually difficult to find, and it's even more so anymore with all these electronic computers and these vast resources these banks have. They can grab arbitrages, and the transaction fees are virtually nil for them. But that arbitrage is essential to price discipline, because if there is an arbitrage, it's going to force the price that is over down or the price that's under up. And it does it very rapidly. I'll give you I think I already mentioned that this one. I have actually achieved arbitrage just a few, rarely. I can do it with options pricing, where I will see a price that is not what it should be. And so I will, if it's a little bit too low, according to the theoretical model. So I'll buy it, and it will bump up. Of course, there are others who are seeing it too, and we're all diving in and buying if it's an underprice. And of course, that pushes the price up and gets it back into line very quickly. In one case, I saw an arbitrage move. It was actually pretty nice, and I took just maybe 5 seconds to run to my little Excel model that calculates the the actual theoretical price, just to make sure. Couldn't have been gone more than 5 seconds. I got back and the price differential was gone. And I thought, you know, really? Couldn't you have waited for like 5 seconds for my ass to get a few bucks here? No, it closes very rapidly. However, it does happen. And there are some interesting examples of what's called liquidity arbitrage, and I think I've mentioned that, where before a market opens, you can put in a bid that is lowball to what the actual, you can put in an order to buy something at a price that is below what it should be. Like, for example, it was about 4 weeks ago, I saw that the market was coming in at 110, so I put in a bid at 103. I put in an order. I shouldn't say a bid. I put in an order at 103. And I thought, maybe. Sure enough, when the market opened, it just grabbed that instantly. And within 2-3 minutes, it went back up to where it should have been. But there was a small arbitrage just grabbed it. And so about every week or so, I just put in a random bid that's a little bit on the low side before the market opens, in case there's a liquidity gap there and someone wants to unload and they say, someone wants to, let's clear this off the books before the market, just when the market starts, and it's zoom, and it's there, and then the price pops, and then I've got myself a little profit right there. It happens. Not often, but it's worth a try. Anytime you want to just for shots and giggles and all that kind of stuff. Okay, back to locational arbitrage. Okay. Now, I caution you that I've got some graphics up here, and some of these graphics are also in the PowerPoint. My graphics are a little more detailed than the ones that you'll see in the PowerPoint for this chapter. They were originals, and in some cases, they deleted some stuff that I had put in there or someone else had put in there. And in some cases, they split something up into 2 or 3 slides. It actually makes more sense if it's one slide explaining everything in a graphical way. So I caution you that I will have these available for you, and there is a PowerPoint version, but these may be a little bit more detailed in some cases. Okay, the different kinds of arbitrage. There is locational arbitrage. That's where you're taking advantage of a price difference in separate locations. You know, duh. I should point out here that you may have heard somewhere before the law of one price. Have you ever heard that? You may have heard it and just kind of dispensed with it. It's actually an important concept that in a competitive market, the price should be the same everywhere. That's in a nutshell. That's the law of one price. It's the same everywhere. Even if it's in different denominations, it's the same. That's how we, remember I showed you that purchasing power parity? We're assuming the law of one price in doing that purchasing power parity calculation with market baskets of goods in different countries. The law of one price says they should be the same price regardless of what the currency is. The currency should merely reflect the law of one price. Okay, so in other words, locational arbitrage is small differences in location, as I gave you in that Canadian example. Now, another one that is out there is what's called triangular arbitrage. Triangular arbitrage is where you take advantage of a cross-exchange difference. And I'll show you one of these. They're actually cool, and you can, these happen. And I'll get more into it on Wednesday when I show you interest rate arbitrage. But they do happen. Cross-exchange arbitrage is actually one of the mechanisms by which exchange rates are disciplined. Because a whole lot of traders, speculators are constantly looking for exchange for triangular arbitrage opportunities. In other words, it's two currencies that aren't the U.S. dollar are out of whack with each other or with the dollar, one of them is. And so you attack one, use that to get the other one, and then use that one to come back and get the dollar. It works, and I even know young woman. Well, she's not young anymore, but she's done that for years, and she's made a decent money. She said in the past few years it's almost impossible because of these massive computer speculators and all that, but she did a good job of it over time. So there's locational, there's triangular, and then there is this one that's like an interest rate arbitrage. And this is a whole world of its own. Essentially, it's taking advantage of interest rate differences that aren't supposed to be there. Now, interest rates in different countries are different. But there is a certain degree to which those interest rates are too different. And you can take advantage of that using exchange rates. And I'll show you that one today. But we'll get into the more important part of it in the lecture on Wednesday, where I'll show you how you can pull this with futures contracts. But for the most part, interest rate arbitrage is done using forward contracts with banks. And there are some brokers that are sort of like quasi-banks that'll do this for you too. The one thing you have to watch out for is in... Let me ask a question here. Are any of you familiar with the term front running? It's illegal, and it's done all the time, and it has been done forever. And in fact, matter of fact, you are most likely, if you are trading with anything from Robinhood to Fidelity to TD Ameritrade, you are a victim of front running. You don't know it, and you never will. Okay, anyone know about it? Know what it is? Okay, everyone in this class, you all do trading, and if you're like me, you suck at it. You are terrible. I mean, you shouldn't be doing this. You should be buying lottery tickets because you are so bad at it. Okay, however, there are algorithms, algos as we call them, that identify winners. Same as at a casino. There are people who are winning too damn much. And those programs find the winners who are traders. And then they start watching their trades. And if the winning keeps going, and sometimes it'll last, and we even have algorithms that tell us how long a winner is going to have a run. We'll start, get your order, you are the winner. Too often. So what we do is whenever you put in an order, we'll put in an order like yours, except massive and in front of yours. That's called front running. It's simply finding a successful trader and then doing his transactions after you have done the same transaction in front of him. Now, obviously, you would might say, you saw a price that is too low. You just buy randomly something that shouldn't be that unusual, but there you are buying it, and you win too often. So what I'm going to do is I am going to get in front of you. You put in an order for 100 shares. Well, I'm going to put in an order for 10,000 shares of that. Of course, what's going to happen is that'll push the price up, and then you'll get your order, but it won't clear at your price. Or if it clears at all, because you'll probably put, if you're smart, you'll put a limit, price limit on it. Okay, so you'd say to yourself, oh, well, that can't happen because of the small order entry system. Small orders are allowed to go in before, must go in before large orders do. So you know what we do these days? We just set up hundreds of accounts, and each of them orders a couple of round lots. And so we get in as small orders, and we beat you. Your transaction is going to happen within a couple of seconds. Ours will happen within less than a second. So you'll see it, one, two, there, darn it, it went up. You got it? That's front running. This happens in triangular arbitrage. Because if you do it with almost any bank or broker, if you're just a guy off the street, they're going to ignore you for a while. But if you keep winning at triangular arbitrage, we're going to start keeping an eye on what currencies are you doing and why are you doing this? Well, let's get in front of that and do a few of those trades ourselves. See how good you are. Damn, you are good. Let's wait until you do another one and we'll lean in further into it. We'll close that arbitrage gap faster than you can make, we'll execute your trade. Okay, so do appreciate that. Yes, I know, shocking, the world is full of crooks. Hard to believe. Anyway. Okay, then the last one, interest rate arbitrage. It's actually kind of a logical thing. You exchange dollars for some currency, you use that currency to buy another currency, which you invest at this unusually high interest rate, and then 90 days later, you come in, you cash in, and then you trade the foreign currency back for your own currency at a profit. I'll show you one in a second. You'll get the hang of it pretty quickly here. I mean, a lot of these aren't rocket science. What's the hard part is actually getting the guts to actually do it the first time. I mean, there's something about doing this that tells you, I am working with a lot of leverage here. I could get my ass kicked, and then getting over that. So anyway, with that in mind, let's go back to locational arbitrage. There we go. Okay. Now, this is a dramatic example. You probably won't see him this wide, but what you're going to do here is that you're going to use dollars to buy U.S. dollars to buy New Zealand dollars at 640, okay? You're going to pay the ask for at North Bank, okay? 640. Then you take those New Zealand dollars and you run over to the South Bank where you sell them at 645 per dollar. You pocket the change. That's all there is. That's locational arbitrage. Does it work? It's still to this day, to a certain extent, you can. I mean, these are wide spreads. I mean, your spread between your bid on North and your ask on South is 0.015, which is a pretty wide spread. It's going to be more likely to be pennies, less than a penny. However, if you're doing this with a couple of grand every day, well, then you can make a living at it. And this is causes a price discipline. Because clearly what's going to happen is that the bid-ask at the North Bank is going to up and the bid and or the bid-ask at the South Bank is going to slip downward. Most likely it will be on the North Bank side. The bid and the ask will start to converge with the South Bank. Okay? And there's always this thing, well, there will be a difference always because of transactions fees. That's not as relevant now as it used to be because the transaction fees are so tiny anymore, especially if your round trips are within a few minutes of each other. Literally, you can do this on a computer if you know how to set up your trades. You can do this on a computer, just eyeing the different banks and what they're quoting different currencies at. You can pull this off. The one thing that I caution you about is that you're going to have a liquidity problem if you see if you're playing with any currency that is a second or third world currency. You're going to see bid asks at some banks that are a lot different from bid asks at other banks. But when you try to execute an arbitrage, a locational arbitrage, it's just not going to work because the liquidity isn't there, and they'll say, I'm sorry, we'll just have to wait until we get that bid ask up. They won't trade it for you. So you've got to be careful about, wow, I just noticed that the Vietnamese dong here is at a different exchange rate to the dollar than the Vietnamese dong is at this bank over on the other coast. Yeah, that's great, except that that is a false signal because it's just a liquidity difference, and it's not going to pay off anywhere. That's locational arbitrage, not hard at all, and you can calculate, oh, geez, I made a little bit of money on the swing there. Nothing big, obviously. You'd have to use a lot of money to do this, and I encourage you that if you have a paper trading account and you have currency ability, try it out. You'll find that sometimes it's not as hard as you think it is to get locational arbitrage to make you a little money. Now, is it worth your time? You're going to be spending hours watching currencies, and so there's that opportunity cost of your time involved. But if you've got an algo that can do it, that can watch, you give it a set of currencies at different banks, and it gives you a screaming signal if there is a sufficient difference between the bid-ask at one bank and the bid-ask at another bank on one of your currencies. You know, just put in a packet of 10 different currencies and see if there are any that have the algo yell at you that there's more than a certain difference between them. Now, let's go to triangular arbitrage here. I caution you that the PowerPoint is like two or three slides, and I put it all on here. But we're going to do this with the Malaysian ringgit and the British pound sterling. There is a potential for a difference here. Now, what you're going to do is, now this is the one with bid ask. They do it in the book and in the PowerPoints without the bid ask being involved. But you might as well see the whole nine yards here. So what we're going to do is we're going to exchange dollars for pounds at 161. Okay, you're buying, so you would be paying the ask. Okay, you're buying, so you're going to pay the ask. Key on the ask there, 161. Okay, so that means that your $10,000 that you're going to put into the kitty is going to get you 6,211 pounds, GBPs. Okay, so now you are going to use those to buy ringgits. Now you're going to buy the value of the ringgit, which is on the purchase side, it's going to be $8.20 ringgits is 1 pound. So you're going to be able to gather up 50,310 ringgits you've got 6,211 pounds. That is going to, at the current 820 ringgits to the pound, that will get you at the ask, that's going to get you 50,310 ringgits. And you'll have to look at this a couple of times just yourself. And I've got this graphic. It'll be in your resources tab. Don't worry about that. But I'm just walking you through it. Again, I use $10,000 and I paid $1.61 per pound to get 6,211 pounds. Yeah.
So when you're exchanging the euro for the ringgit, are you exchanging it to the bid or the ask?
The dollar, you mean?
No, step two. The ringgit at the bottom.
Let me calculate that. Hang on here. Calculator. Okay, so I'm going to go and I am going to sell pounds to buy ringgits. So I'm going to sell at 50,000, I'm going to take 6,211 pounds times $8.10. So you're going to buy at the bid. Well, you're not buying at the bid. You are actually selling pounds is what you're doing. So you're going to sell them at the ringgit exchange. You're selling pounds. So you're going to get I'm glad you brought that up, the bid, because the transaction is you are selling pounds. So you're going to sell them at the bid. That's a good catch, though. I didn't say that clearly. Again, on the first leg, you're going to be buying pounds at the bid, at the ask. Jeez. You're going to be buying pounds at the ask. On the second leg, you're going to be selling pounds at the bid for pounds. Again, on the first leg, you're going to be buying pounds, so you will pay the ask, pounds to dollars. But on the second leg, you are selling the pounds, so you're going to sell them at the bid to get the ringgits. So you might want to put up here that you're going to take 10,000 divided by 1.61. On the second leg, you are going to be selling the pounds, and you'll get 8.10 ringgits per pound. So in other words, you will take 6,211 times $8.10. So on this leg, you put in I should have put that in there. I do apologize. I never even thought of that. 6,211 times 8.10. That's how you get the 50310, which is technically 50,309.1, and I just rounded it. So again, on this leg, one more time, you're going to do 6,211 times the bid on the ringgit pound, which is 810. Okay? Now, finally, you swing back up around and you say, okay, now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to exchange those ringgits for dollars. So I'm going to take 50,000 310, I don't know why I didn't round that down, but I didn't, because I'm selling the ringgits, so I'm going to sell them at the bid. So in other words, that last leg, the 10,062, is going to be the 50,310 times 0.20. Again, the last leg, because I am going to sell ringgits, I'm going to sell them at the bid. So when I do that, I am going to get 50,310 ringgits times $0.20 per ringgit. And I pocket, in this case, $62. Go.
Since you're selling, you have to wait for a buy order?
No. That's why I was talking about third world currencies. If there's a high degree of liquidity, and I'm not so sure, Malaysia is pretty good, but it'll just instantly happen. The problem comes if there's not liquidity. You might wait and you might not get what you want. But if it's a reasonably, if there's good liquidity in the market, well, yeah, it's going to execute instantly, or at least within a second on this. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, well, big whoop-de-doo. I made $62 frickin' for 10 grand. But if you did this swing in a matter of, let's say, 10 minutes, what's your interest going to cost you on borrowing $10,000? It's going to be virtually nothing. You could do this with leverage. I wouldn't do it with a whole lot of money. You don't want to trigger notice, okay? If you did this with $1 million, yeah, someone would feel that. And then they'd say, what's he up to? You might even trigger some visits from men in black from the government or some crap like that. They seem to be very interested. They'll let these ginormous companies do things that if a small-time player does it, they will come and kick your ass for this kind of stuff. But, I mean, if you were to do this like a couple of times a day, you know, maybe five times a day with 20 to 50 grand on each swing, and you show that you're good for it, you're going to have to set up a relationship with a bank to do this. You don't want to use your own $10,000 for God's sake for this. They might say, well, you got to put skin in the game, maybe 2,000, but you want to set it up so that you're using OPM, if you remember what OPM is, other people's money, okay? And if you can do that, you can do it. Make it an engine. What currencies? You name a decent currency. Like I said, the Malaysian ringgit is a little on the edge there, and you don't want to do it with euros because it ain't going to work. What you want to do is find one that's kind of there in the border area where there can be these slight differences on the triangle. And the cross-exchange rate can have deviations. What currencies are you talking about? You don't want to do the yuan because everyone watches yuan. The yen, I don't know. You look at currencies, I don't know. There are some currencies in Africa that are worth having a look at. There are some currencies in Asia. I wouldn't play around with Myanmar, what with their problems and their dictatorship. But look at some of the other currencies around there, Singapore, I don't know, Cambodia, that's a little bit dodgy there. I'd look at the rupee. I would definitely have a look at the rupee for something like this. And I might look at a few other currencies, too. Just make sure they're not pegged to the dollar, for God's sake. Yeah.
Have you identified when they're as a
bond? Say that again?
How can you identify when you can make money off?
You do the calculation. You set it up as an algo in Excel. You just let the numbers feed in through some kind of a program you've got, and just it'll just go instantly. They'll say, don't talk to me unless I've got more than, let's say, $50 per 10,000, okay? But if it's going to work, give me a signal, and I'll execute a trade. You just keep prowling. You're constantly looking for these.
So you pretty much have to calculate the whole triangle as no
shortcuts? No. Well, there is, but, I mean, who wants to do things boring? And besides which, if you're doing it on your own, then you have the chance to be a little creative on this. I'm looking at this and I'm seeing 0.200, 0.201. That's interesting, but that's an awfully tight bid-ask spread there. Maybe I should wait a little bit and see if that tightens up a little, okay? Or spreads out a little bit. You don't want to execute if there's a possibility that it might get a little bit juicier in a few minutes, or in an hour or two, or maybe tomorrow. But this is one of those things where you get, a lot of times the algo will say, here's an interesting situation, but you'll know very well that it's not really worth your time right now, but you keep seeing these kinds of cross-exchange differentials, and there's an arbitrage possibility. So once you know that a currency cross-exchange is subject to potential arbitrage, that's when you start keying in on and you say, watch this every day. Okay. Here's covered interest arbitrage in a nutshell. And I swear to you, once we get through this, I'll let you go because this will make you want to go lie down for a while. It's actually not complicated once you get the hang of it. Okay. You are going to realize an interest rate differential between two countries. And like I said, interest rates in different countries are going to be different. What you're looking for is a difference that is unmerited by the differences in that equation. Remember that equation, exchange rates, the change in inflation, difference in inflation, difference in expectations, government controls, interest rates, and all that. Okay. You want to find one that is not what it should be, okay? Now, the covering of it might not make sense at first, but what you're trying to do is you are trying to hedge exchange rate risk, okay? Believe it or not, these are exchange rates, but you don't want the exchange rates to bite you in the ass. Technically, you don't want the interest rates to bite you in the ass either. But once you've locked in the deal, then it can go forward. This is, by the way, what George Soros did. And he made $2 billion back in the early 1990s doing this. He did nothing but pure interest arbitrage. But he had a juicer in there too. Now, what this will do is over time, because the demand for the currency that has the interest rates that's too low is going to go up, increased demand will cause that interest rate to nudge upward, the market interest rate to edge upward, because everyone's going to see this. Everyone's going to start borrowing money in that currency to take advantage of the interest rate in another country. So in other words, if I borrow dollars, I might be able to get a higher interest rate by turning them into euros and saving them, putting them in an account for a while, earn the higher interest rate, and then cash it out, and then pay it back. Let me say that one more time. I see that, let's say, the European interest rate is abnormally higher than the U.S. interest rate. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get money in dollars, and I'm going to then use that money to put into an interest-bearing account in the European currency, which has an unusually high interest rate. Okay, and then in 90 days, what I can do is take that out and pay back the loan that I got for the $10,000 or whatever it was. Along the way, though, I'm going to set up a forward contract for delivery of the currency, so that I lock in, so that I don't have to worry about the currency swinging on me during the intervening period. Watch. And like I said, this is not something that I expect you to know right away. As a matter of fact, we do this a couple of times just to get you used to it. Okay, here we go. Now, this is not exactly how it's in the PowerPoints you're going to see or in the book. I'm putting in some notations there to help you understand the flow. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to go to an exchange bank, and you're going to say, I should like to exchange $800,000 for 500,000 pounds. The exchange rate right now is 1 pound is $1.60. $1.60. Okay. So what I'm going to do then is I'm going to take that 500,000 pounds, and I'm going to deposit it in an account that's 4%. Which I think is an unusually high compared to what it should be. I'm going to deposit that money. Notice that putting that in there, that's going to increase the supply of pounds in the banking system. Ultimately, that will lower the interest rate on pounds, but it hasn't yet because I'm going to do this quickly, and so I'm going to lock in 4%. Now, in 90 days, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that and earn 4% times 90 days times 500,000 pounds, and I get 520,000 pounds, which I then exchange at 1 pound equals $1.60. However, I've got to make sure that I lock in this. This is the problem right here. That exchange rate could move on me. So I don't want that. So what I'm going to take is a forward contract and I'm going to deliver 520,000 pounds in 90 days at the lock of 1 pound equals $1.6. Now, why am I using a forward contract instead of a futures contract? You're just looking at me. That's cool. This is how this works. Why? Can you tell me this? Why am I, in that little intermediate step there, why am I using a forward contract to lock in the 1 pound equals 1.6? Go. Bingo. I couldn't do that with a futures. They're always in blocks. Oh, you will do it with this amount of currency. I don't want to do it with that amount of currency. I want to do it with an exact amount that is customized to what I am going to get delivered back to me. You see, I'm getting a pounds delivered back to me in 90 days. I'm getting 520 pounds, 520,000 pounds delivered back to me in 90 days. So I've damn well got to better make sure that I have someone who's going to take delivery of 520,000 pounds in 90 days. Go. You do them simultaneously. I don't know what that... Yes, I do know what that means. You can do them at the same time. You don't want to do one in front of the other because you could get caught with your pants down. In other words, what could happen here is, okay, I've got the, I'm going to get 520,000 pounds in 90 days. I know that now because I locked in a 4% interest rate in the Bank of England or something like that. Okay. So I damn well better make sure that I have got someone who's going to take 520,000 pounds in 90 days. So that means I at 1 pound equals $1.6. So I've got to make sure right away that I can dump these damn pounds at the same time. But I don't want to do it in front of, because then I'm thinking to myself, okay, what happens if I do that and then that interest rate drops to 3% or 2%? I've got to do them very close to each other, if not simultaneously. You essentially set up a block trade. Okay, I'm going to make arrangements so that I get 500,000 pounds for $800,000. At the same time, I'm going to talk to the bank in England and say, jolly good, I am going to deliver 500,000 pounds to you in just a couple of minutes. And then you go up here, you say, I need a forward contract to deliver 520,000 pounds. Well, how do you know 520,000 pounds? You know that because you put it in at 4%. You lock that, and then you go up there and say, I will have 520,000 pounds, and I want to deliver them to some sucker, or some person, excuse me, at one pound equals $1.6. So you see, you got to do it all very quickly, sort of like a setup. You're making these calls, or you're setting up on your computer, blip, confirm, and then you sit there for 90 days, and then it expires. You get that $520,000 out of that account that was bearing 4% per year, 4%, and you get that $520,000, and it automatically is delivered to the buyer of your forward contract, and you then you just sit there, and you have collected. You got $832,000. You delivered 520,000 pounds at one pound equals $1.6, so you get $832,000. And you walk away with $32,000. That's all. Does this work? Yes, it does. Is it done? All the freaking time. This is how you create interest rates. This is why interest rates are so disciplined in the international markets. Is that you can pull this. Back in my time, these were done. There were different places you could do it. The best way that we did it was to set up a branch of a continental bank, someplace like the Dutch Antilles or the Isle of Man, or hell, in one case, I had nothing to do with this. There was one in the Shetland Islands, for God's sake. If you've ever been to the Shetland Islands, you're saying there's actual humans there. Yes, but matter of fact, I have long-distant ancestors who still live in the Orkney Islands. They're considered the rednecks of Scotland, if you can believe that. But anyway, so what we would do is we would set up a bank that was a main continental bank. And then we would deliver to the bank, let's say in the Dutch Antilles, the 500,000 pounds. Back in that day, it would maybe Deutschmarks back then. You deliver 500,000 Deutschmarks, okay, to that one. Earn the interest of the Continental Bank, and then you would set up the forward contract so that it was essentially just like you see there, and you would pocket the difference. Now, why weren't we just doing it through the bank on the continent, through the Deutsche Bank or through some European bank? Why were we doing it in these offshore banks that were branches, essentially branches, of the continental banks? Why were we doing it offshore? Anyone got an idea? Well, that's easy. We didn't have to report anything. Nothing happened as far as the radar of the U.S. regulators, the European regulators. It was a wash. Do you see how these are wash sales? At the end, it disappears. That's $32,000. Well, that just shuttles into an account that's a blank check account in the Dutch Antilles or on the Isle of Man. And then it's like nothing ever happened. It's a wash sale. But if you do it on the continent, they have to keep the books and the records, and you've got the regulators and all this kind of stuff watching everything you're doing. But if you do it in a branch offshore, and now why would the banks on the continent be involved in this? Because there are fees involved in this. And if you're churning a couple of million dollars a day in a branch on the Isle of Man, you're collecting a fee of maybe $1,000 or $2,000 for each of the transactions, which goes onto the books of the main bank as fees paid by a branch for using the name of the main bank, the Continental Bank, and then you were fine. That was how it worked. And it was a wonderful way to essentially, don't get me wrong, this wasn't money laundering. This was merely making money without having snoops ask you what you were doing. I don't think I ever saw this being used for money laundering. It was just to keep it from the nosy government people. And also to keep it from nosy other rich people who didn't know how to do this so that they wouldn't come in unless you invited them in. And there was an invitation system if you wanted to get involved in it. And it was, essentially, it was a token system back then. They were these little coins, and you would give it to someone who'd asked you about it, and you figured he was good family, wealthy people, and they were not blabbermouths, they were very secretive, and you'd give them a token, and then that token could be used on a vacation to the Isle of Man, and the token could be delivered to the bank, and then that's how you got in, was through essentially a token reference. God, I shouldn't teach you this stuff. Almost like you might want to go out and try to do it yourselves, for God's sake. Okay, let me get off that one. Now, here's the interesting thing, though, is that these forwards are the ones that are actually doing the adjustment back to equilibrium. You see, this is a disequilibrium. This should not happen. Like I said, this is not what should happen. You see, because when I deliver those 500,000 pounds to that British bank, that will increase the supply of pounds. And ultimately, as the supply of pounds goes up, the interest rate on pounds will settle back down. That creates the price discipline right there, is that supply moving forward. However, you need to make sure that you have a place to put that money that you have when it comes back out in 90 days. You're going to get $520,000. You damn well better make sure that you have locked in someone who's going to take that off your hands at the current exchange rate. Then, when that person takes delivery of the 1.6 1 pound equals $1.6 and all that kind of stuff. If it's not a good price, they're going to be pissed about it, and that in itself is going to make the next round more difficult. Because the next round, the exchange rates are going to move to take away that candy that you just did. No one's going to take a 1 pound equals $1.6 dollars after you've made money off them on this. If the pound depreciates relative to the dollar, that person is going to get burned, and so the next round of forward contracts isn't going to be at 1 pound equals 1.60. It's going to be at 1 pound equals $1.5. The currency will depreciate because you have delivered an overpriced currency to someone who entered the contract quite honestly. There was no force in it, but you delivered a currency that was overvalued, possibly. Yeah, about that. The bid-ask spread is going to be a bit of an issue. Never mind on the buying and selling of the pounds and the dollars and all that kind of stuff. There is actually a slight bid-ask spread on interest rates, too. Okay? So, in a sense, you've got to be careful. That might be that 4%. Might be a bid of 3.95 and an ask of 4.01. There might be a bid-ask spread. How big is it? With high liquidity currencies, that bid is very tight. I don't worry too much about it. It might be 3.99, 4.00. It's not going to be much as long as you are using currencies that are pretty obvious, pretty good. Yeah, and one other thing there, of course, obviously, there's got to be a spot and a forward. The mark, there's got to be people who buy forward contracts in the currency that you want to deliver. That just has to be there. So in other words, if you're working with, let's say, some weird currency like the CD of Ghana, yeah, I'd like to do a forward contract with you to deliver CDs for dollars. And they're going to say, no, you're not going to find anyone who wants to deliver those. On the other hand, if I had gotten involved in that game I told you about with the pesos and the dollars, this would have been freaking phenomenal for a way, because there would have been all kinds of interest in the delivery of dollars here to deal with foreign exchange risk in Mexico. But that's another day's story. Okay. What are the arbitrage effects of these? Remember that there is the locational, there's the triangular, and then finally there's the covered interest arbitrage. And we call it covered because of that forward contract in there. In a case like this, you know, you're going to make sure that you're going to get exchange rates on the locational. It's going to force discipline in the exchange rates. Anymore, the electronic systems are just fantastic for getting the exchange rate so that it's very hard to find differences in exchange rates from one bank to another bank. If you want to be... I'm recording this, for God's sake. Okay. If you want to be a bad person, you go looking for banks that are... You look for banks that have officials that feel that they deserve to be more important than they are. That they want their bank to grow. They want to be known as the founder someday of a bank that started out as a modest little community bank in the backwaters of Peoria, Illinois. Hence why it is one of the big things that, excuse me. Now, I place young people in jobs, And one of the jobs that is always needs people are these auditor people for the auditing teams for the comptroller of the currency. They have banks that are under their supervisory and regulatory control, and one of the things they do is they go to these banks and they look at the types of loans they have on the book. Well, one thing they want to make sure is that they don't have too many loans of a certain kind, because that exposes them abnormally to certain risks. Another thing they want to make sure is that these banks aren't exposing themselves or overexposing themselves to speculative investments that are not nearby. Hence why, as one comptroller audit team leader explained, we find these banks that are making loans for high-rise condo projects for rich people in Chicagoland. You're a bank here in downstate, and you are one of the lenders to these guys up in Chicago who are going to build a high-rise luxury condo complex in Chicago. Well, yeah, they're really honest, and they took us up there, and they showed us everything, and boy, we had some great meals up there and all that kind of stuff, and I mean, we got to see some things you wouldn't believe. Yeah, and we figured it was good for our money to diversify our loan portfolio, so we put $10 million into that project. We don't see any particular risk, and you understand. Okay, the same thing can happen with this kind of stuff. You can start to work on small banks. Do you have any exchange rate experience? Well, we've been looking into it, and we're just kind of getting started with it. Well, I'll tell you what. You know, I had this incredible professor who taught me how to do this, and maybe we can start with something small, you know, some exchange rate work, and move up from there. Sometimes you can find a bank where you can get them to give you special deals because they want to move up the food chain just as much as you do. It can happen. Now, that's, of course, wrong to do that because they should never be involved in this, and you shouldn't be the one who encourages them to be involved in this. But then again, there are a lot of things we shouldn't do in this life that we do. Oh, like drink that stuff during class. God. Okay, enough of that. Okay. The one thing that you can do, and it's not really captured here, if you do this on a regular basis, and you do it for the right reason, you can reduce the transactions cost considerably simply because if you can do this for a bank all the time, they might start out with some pretty steep transactions cost. Well, this is going to cost a lot of money to set this up. Okay, once you've set it up, why are you still charging me what you did when this was the first time we did this? You create a relationship so that the transactions cost can get down to a reasonable level. And if they keep having these high transactions costs in some exchange environment, a financial intermediary, you begin to start to talk to them about, well, I want to make sure that you're not making money off something we call front running when you're doing this. You're not doing this in front of us, are you? That can help encourage them to reduce your transactions costs by letting them know that you're not going to take their bullshit. Now, this is just a graphic. It's in the PowerPoints, and I've also got this also. You can just pull this up. And it's just giving you a summary of what these do, why you would do them, what would be the purpose. And obviously, if it's arbitrage, there is one and only one purpose to arbitrage. Just like there is really one and only one purpose to doing any kind of business whatsoever. Do you know what that reason is to do business, to start a company, to run a company? Money. Exactly. You're not doing it for the good of the world. You're not doing it to reduce transactions costs. You're not doing it to tighten exchange rate bid asks. You're not doing it for any of those reasons whatsoever. You are doing this purely because it will make money for you. This was going back to Adam Smith, enlightened self-interest. As long as we are doing something that is for the good of our profit, and we are obeying laws, then ultimately everyone benefits from what we are doing. We create efficiency through greed. If you were my student, you know my little speech. Greed is not an evil. Greed is good. Greed clarifies, it clears the market of weak participants, and it forces price discipline on the markets. In this case, we don't do this to tighten exchange rates. We don't do this to get interest rates aligned. We don't give a rat's ass about that. As a matter of fact, we love it when they're not aligned. We love it when there's one bank that's going to get screwed as another one makes up off another one's profit from our exchange rate locational arbitrage. But at the same time, by doing this, we cause these benefits to the global exchange rate markets. That's why we do it. Okay? If that sounds cruel, well, fine arts needs some students, and sociology does too. And as a matter of fact, there's a dance club starting next week where you can express your unhappiness at capitalism. But for today, that's all I have for you here in the capitalist world. I thank you.